Chapter 8. Wei Enough recalled him to himself. They were in the shadow of the yacht and coming alongside her ladder. The master of the brig looked upward into the face of a gentleman, with long whiskers and a shaved chin, staring down at him over the side through a single eyeglass. As he put his foot on the bottom step, he could see the shore smoke still ascending, unceasing and thick. But even as he looked, the very base of the black pillar rose above the ragged line of treetops. The whole thing floated clear away from the earth, and rolling itself into an irregularly shaped mass, drifted out to seaward, traveling slowly over the blue heavens, like a threatening and lonely cloud. Part 2. The shore of refuge, the coast off which the little brig, floating upright above her anchor, seemed to guard the high hull of the yacht, has no distinctive features. It is land without form. It stretches away without cape or bluff, long, and low indefinitely, and when the heavy gusts of the northeast monsoon drive the thick rain slanting over the sea, it is seen faintly under the gray sky, black and with a blurred outline like the straight edge of a dissolving shore. In the long season of unclouded days, it presents to view only a narrow band of earth that appears crushed flat upon the vast level of waters by the weight of the sky, whose immense dome rests on it in a line as fine and true as that of the sea horizon itself. Notwithstanding its nearness to the centers of European power, this coast has been known for ages to the armed wanderers of these seas as the shore of refuge. It has no specific name on the charts, and geography manuals don't mention it at all, but the wreckage of many defeats unerringly drifts into its creeks. Its approaches are extremely difficult for a stranger. Looked at from seaward, the innumerable islets fringing what, on account of its vast size, may be called the mainland, merge into a background that presents not a single landmark to point the way through the intricate channels. It may be said that in a belt of sea 20 miles broad along that low shore there is much more coral, mud, sand, and stones than actual sea water. It was amongst the outlying shoals of this stretch that the yacht had gone ashore, and the events consequent upon her stranding took place. The diffused light of the short daybreak showed the open water to the westward, sleeping, smooth and gray, under a faded heaven. The straight coast threw a heavy belt of gloom along the shoals, which, in the calm of expiring night, were unmarked by the slightest ripple. In the faint dawn, the low clumps of bushes on the sandbanks appeared immense. Two figures, noiseless like two shadows, moved slowly over the beach of a rocky islet, and stopped side by side on the very edge of the water. Behind them, between the mats from which they had arisen, a small heap of black embers smoldered quietly. They stood upright and perfectly still, but for the slight movement of their heads from right to left, and back again as they swept their gaze through the gray emptiness of the waters where, about 2 miles distant, the hull of the yacht loomed up to seaward, black and shapeless, against the wan sky. The two figures looked beyond without exchanging as much as a murmur. The taller of the two grounded, at arm's length, the stock of a gun with a long barrel, the hair of the other fell down to its waist, and, nearby, the leaves of creepers drooping from the summit of the steep rock stirred no more than the festooned stone. The faint light, disclosing here and there a gleam of white sandbanks, and the blurred hummocks of islets scattered within the gloom of the coast, the profound silence, the vast stillness all round, accentuated the loneliness of the two human beings who, urged by a sleepless hope, had risen thus, at break of day, to look afar upon the veiled face of the sea. "Nothing," said the man with a sigh, and as if awakening from a long period of musing. He was clad in a jacket of coarse blue cotton, of the kind a poor fisherman might own, and he wore it wide open on a muscular chest the color and smoothness of bronze. From the twist of threadbare sarong wound tightly on the hips protruded outward to the left the ivory hilt, ringed with 6 bands of gold, of a weapon that would not have disgraced a ruler. Silver glittered about the flintlock and the hardwood stock of his gun. The red and gold handkerchief folded round his head was of costly stuff, such as is woven by high-born women in the households of chiefs. Only the gold threads were tarnished, and the silk frayed in the folds. His head was thrown back, the dropped eyelids narrowed the gleam of his eyes. His face was hairless, the nose short with mobile nostrils, and the smile of careless good humor seemed to have been permanently wrought, as if with a delicate tool, into the slight hollows about the corners of rather full lips. His upright figure had a negligent elegance. But in the careless face, in the easy gestures of the whole man there was something attentive and restrained. After giving the offing a last searching glance, he turned, and, facing the rising sun, walked barefooted on the elastic sand. The trailed butt of his gun made a deep furrow. The embers had ceased to smolder. He looked down at them pensively for a while, then called over his shoulder to the girl who had remained behind, still scanning the sea. "The fire is out, Imada." At the sound of his voice the girl moved toward the mats. Her black hair hung like a mantle. Her sarong, the kilt-like garment which both sexes wear, had the national check of gray and red, but as he had not completed her attire by the belt, scarves, the loose upper wrappings, and the head covering of a woman. A black silk jacket, like that of a man of rank, was buttoned over her bust and fitted closely to her slender waist. The edge of a stand-up collar, stiff with gold embroidery, rubbed her cheek. As he had no bracelets, no anklets, and although dressed practically in man's clothes, had about her person no weapon of any sort. Her arms hung down in exceedingly tight sleeves slid a little way up from the wrist, gold braided and with a row of small gold buttons. She walked, brown and alert, all of a piece, with short steps, the eyes lively in an impassive little face, the arched mouth closed firmly, and her whole person breathed in its rigid grace the fiery gravity of youth at the beginning of the task of life at the beginning of beliefs and hopes. This was the day of Lingard's arrival upon the coast, but, as is known, the brig, delayed by the calm, did not appear in sight of the shallows till the morning was far advanced. Disappointed in their hope, to see the expected sail shining in the first rays of the rising sun, the man and the woman, without attempting to relight the fire, lounged on their sleeping mats. At their feet a common canoe, hauled out of the water, was, for more security, moored by a grass rope to the shaft of a long spear planted firmly on the white beach, and the incoming tide lapped monotonously against its stern. The girl, twisting up her black hair, fastened it with slender wooden pins. The man, reclining at full length, had made room on his mat for the gun as one would do for a friend, and, supported on his elbow, looked toward the yacht with eyes whose fixed dreaminess like a transparent veil would show the slow passage of every gloomy thought, by deepening gradually into a somber stare. "We have seen three sunrises on this islet, and no friend came from the sea," he said without changing his attitude, with his back toward the girl who sat on the other side of the cold embers. "Yes, and the moon is waning," she answered in a low voice. "Tea, the moon is waning. Yeti promised to be here when the nights are light, and the water covers the sandbanks as far as the bushes. The traveler knows the time of his setting out, but not the time of his return," observed the man, calmly. The girl sighed. "The nights of waiting are long," she murmured. "And sometimes they are vain," said the man with the same composure. "Perhaps he will never return." "Why?" exclaimed the girl. "The road is long, and the heart may grow cold," was the answer in a quiet voice. "If he does not return, it is because he has forgotten." "Oh, Hassam, it is because he is dead," cried the girl, indignantly. The man, looking fixedly to seaward, smiled at the ardor of her tone. They were brother and sister, and though very much alike, the family resemblance was lost in the more general traits common to the whole race. They were natives of Wajo, and it is a common saying amongst the Malay race that to be a successful traveler and trader a man must have some Wajo blood in his veins. And with those people trading, which means also traveling afar, is a romantic and an honorable occupation. The trader must possess an adventurous spirit and a keen understanding. He should have the fearlessness of youth and the sagacity of age. He should be diplomatic and courageous, so as to secure the favor of the great and inspire fear in evildoers. These qualities naturally are not expected in a shopkeeper or a Chinaman peddler. They are considered indispensable only for a man who, of noble birth and perhaps related to the ruler of his own country, wanders over the seas, in a craft of his own, and with many followers, carries from island to island important news as well as merchandise, who may be trusted with secret messages and valuable goods. A man who, in short, is as ready to intrigue and fight as to buy and sell. Such is the ideal trader of Weizhou. Trading, thus understood, was the occupation of ambitious men who played an occult, but important part in all those national risings, religious disturbances, and also in the organized piratical movements on a large scale which, during the first half of the last century, affected the fate of more than one native dynasty, and, for a few years at least, seriously endangered the Dutch rule in the East. When, at the cost of much blood and gold, a comparative peace had been imposed on the islands, the same occupation, though shorn of its glorious possibilities, remained attractive for the most adventurous of a restless race. The younger sons and relations of many a native ruler traversed the seas of the archipelago, visited the innumerable and little-known islands, and the then practically unknown shores of New Guinea, every spot where European trade had not penetrated, from Aru to Atjeh, from Sumbawa to Palawan. 2. It was in the most unknown perhaps of such spots, a small bay on the coast of New Guinea, that young Potahasam, the nephew of one of the greatest chiefs of Weizhou, met Lingard for the first time. He was a trader after the Weizhou manner, and in a stout sea-going prah armed with two guns, and manned by young men who were related to his family by blood or dependence, had come in there to buy some birds of paradise skins for the old Sultan of Ternate. A risky expedition undertaken not in the way of business, but as a matter of courtesy toward the aged sultan who had entertained him sumptuously in that dismal brick palace at Ternate for a month or more. While lying off the village, very much on his guard, waiting for the skins and negotiating with the treacherous coast savages who are the go-betweens in that trade, Hassam saw one morning Lingard's brig come to an anchor in the bay, and shortly afterward observed a white man of great stature with a beard that shone like gold, land from a boat and stroll on unarmed, though followed by four Malays of the brig's crew, toward the native village. Hassam was struck with wonder and amazement at the cool recklessness of such a proceeding, and, after, in true Malay fashion, discussing with his people for an hour or so the urgency of the case, he also landed, but well escorted and armed, with the intention of going to see what would happen. The affair really was very simple, such as Lingard would say, such as might have happened to anybody. He went ashore with the intention to look for some stream where he could conveniently replenish his water casks, this being really the motive which had induced him to enter the bay. While, with his men close by and surrounded by a mop-headed, sooty crowd, he was showing a few cotton handkerchiefs, and trying to explain by signs the object of his landing, a spear, lunged from behind, grazed his neck. Probably the Papuan wanted only to ascertain whether such a creature could be killed or hurt, and most likely firmly believed that it could not. But one of Lingard's seamen at once retaliated by striking at the experimenting savage with his parang. Three such choppers brought for the purpose of clearing the bush, if necessary, being all the weapons the party from the brig possessed. A deadly tumult ensued with such suddenness that Lingard, turning round swiftly, saw his defender, already speared in three places, fall forward at his feet. Wasub, who was there, and afterward told the story once a week on an average, used to horrify his hearers by showing how the man blinked his eyes quickly before he fell. Lingard was unarmed. To the end of his life he remained incorrigibly reckless in that respect, explaining that he was much too quick-tempered to carry firearms on the chance of a row. And if put to it, he argued, I can make shift to kill a man with my fist anyhow. And then don't they see you know what you're doing and are not so apt to start a trouble from sheer temper or funksy? In this case he did his best to kill a man with a blow from the shoulder, and catching up another by the middle, flung him at the naked wild crowd. He hurled men about as the wind hurls broken boughs. He made a broad way through our enemies. Related Wasab in his jerky voice. It is more probable that Lingard's quick movements and the amazing aspect of such a strange being caused the warriors to fall back before his rush. Taking instant advantage of their surprise and fear, Lingard, followed by his men, dashed along the kind of ruinous jetty leading to the village which was erected as usual over the water. They darted into one of the miserable huts built of rotten mats and bits of decayed canoes, and in this shelter showing daylight through all its sides, they had time to draw breath, and realize that their position was not much improved. The women and children screaming had cleared out into the bush, while at the shore end of the jetty the warriors capered and yelled, preparing for a general attack. Lingard noticed with mortification that his boatkeeper apparently had lost his head, for, instead of swimming off to the ship to give the alarm, as he... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.